Hi, I'm Mel Majoros. I am a 2-year cancer survivor. My blog, The Cancer Warrior, is one of the top 10 breast cancer blogs, according to blogs.com. I'm here to bring a fresh, upbeat perspective to a topic that to some may seem scary. A positive mental attitude got me through my cancer, and I hope to share that with you. If you found out you had cancer, would you do your treatment right away or put it on hold to follow your dream? Well, today I talked to Pat Moon, a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor who has a great positive mental attitude, and he also raced the Iditarod. How are you doing today, Pat?
Good.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about yourself. I know you wanted to start when you were younger. What happened to you?
When I was 15, I was officially diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. Kind of had typical colitis issues that prompted me to finally go to the doctor, and we did. I was diagnosed and tried a bunch of medicines that didn't really work very well until I was in my low 20s.
Well, what is colitis for people who don't know?
Kind of an autoimmune disease where your body rejects your intestinal system and is kind of constantly inflamed and has horribly bad side effects that just aren't very social, very painful diarrhea, bloating gas, bloody stools, and kind of exacerbated by different health issues that kind of come and go. And when you get into a flare, it's just miserable. It's hard to control anything. So when I was younger, the best way for me to control it was based on diet. So I just ate a very bland diet that didn't have anything that would trigger a reaction from me.
Okay. So basically rice and crackers and...
That's exactly right. A very white rice and bland, no flavor diet until I was into my low 20s. And I found a doctor in the area that had done some different research and kind of had went out on his own to find better ways to treat things and started looking into different medicines that were being tested around the country. And he kind of put me on a myriad of drugs, and some of them worked better than others, but none of them worked really well. And we decided that I definitely had some issues, you know, philosophically with a couple of medicines that most people would try that I don't think they're engineered properly, which is odd for a 22-year-old to be looking at the engineering of medicines rather than anything. And then eventually we rolled upon the biologics, like the autoimmune biologics that they might use for rheumatoid arthritis also.
Oh.
And those have worked wonders for me colitis-wise. It's kind of kept it in check, so I don't have the funny giggles anymore when I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of nowhere or something like that. That has kind of kept that in check for probably the last 6 or 7 years.
Was that kind of rare for someone of your age at that time? Ulcerative colitis, I could even say it.
I don't. It's one of those things where it's not diagnosed a lot because potentially your signs and symptoms are going to be just that you're sick, that you may have a flu bug or something.
Oh.
So unless you have a constant and it's caught early enough, it can potentially, you know, lead to major surgery.
Well, I'm glad that you got it in check. So that, how long has it been since you've had that in check then?
7 or 8 years.
7 or 8 years. So then in 2009, how did you find out you had cancer?
Well, My general practitioner is a 92-year-old doctor who doesn't necessarily know that it's not 1940 anymore.
Awesome.
I barter with him to do all of my medical work takes care of. Yep. And then I was replacing a bathroom sink in his house, and I had just a standard pretty dry cough that if I talked for a long time, I had a cough. He said, well, let's take a look at it. So when the sink was done, looked at my tonsils and said, yeah, your tonsils are kind of big. Let's get them puppies out. Explained to him that, you know, I was kind of in training in the winter to run long-distance dog sled racing. He said, we can squeeze it in between a couple of races. Not a big deal. The great thing about my doctor is if you see him on a Saturday at 4 o'clock in his bathroom underneath the sink, he says, well, go to this doctor at 2 o'clock on Monday.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I call said doctor at 10 o'clock to make an appointment, and they say, no, we're full. And then I call my doctor, and he says, no, that's not what I told you to do. I told you to be there at 2 o'clock. So I say, okay. And I get there at 2 o'clock, and the first name on the door comes out and says, "Hey, you must be Pat Moon. You're so-and-so's patient. Come on back." I went to medical school with him. He looked at it, he said, "Yeah, it looks like you have probably pretty consistent tonsillitis that you just don't know about because you're just coughing, you don't feel good, so let's get them out." In December, they removed them, had them taken out, and did, because I was a relatively healthy 31-year-old at the time, they did standard pathology, and about a month later, they called me back and said, "Well, it came back a little askewed."
It took them a month?
Well, I wasn't here. I was off running dog teams.
Oh,
so
okay.
It didn't take them a month to do it. It probably took them a month to get in contact with me where
oh,
I was.
Oh, okay. I was going to say.
So what they did was they called me in and they said, "Well, here's the problem with this sort of thing. When you're in an area like this, like Chicago, where we get so many of these, we don't run very large gamuts of pathology on things for a normal individual.
Right.
We just run very basic. Unfortunately, you're one of the ones that we wished we would have run more tests on. Oh. Your tonsils came back as atypical lymphoid hyperplasia, which is a precursor to a lot of things. The rest of your tonsil is no longer here, so we can only have the results to go by."
The rest of your tonsil was
disposed of.
Oh, I see.
Just because I'm a very healthy 31-year-old pseudo-professional athlete, they don't keep those things for me.
And see, that's one of the reasons why we have to have this podcast, is because a lot more younger people like yourself are getting cancer. And I think doctors need to be aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it might help somebody else.
Right.
So, just due to my kind of a unique personality, I said, "Hey, that's great. We're in January." And I said, "I'll be back somewhere in April because I'm running a bunch of dog sled races the rest of the year. Is this going to kill me over the next 3 months?" And the answer was, "Oh, no, God, no. You just kind of come back when you're done. We'll deal with this a little bit later." I went back in April, took some blood work, standard MRI, CAT scan, and all that. And I go to a little more progressive of a doctor, I would imagine, than most, where everything is done more on a qualitative scale, on a sliding scale between 1 and 10, 1 being very healthy, 10 being not so healthy. So at least in my case, I like to go by just the numbers, where it's just a sliding scale. So that's how we communicate everything. "How you doing today?" "Oh, I'm a 7. And then when he tells me there's been, my situation is getting better, situation is getting worse, I have a distinct pivotal point of what it was last time. So when I went in April of 2009, we were at about a 6. And then over the summer, over the end of the spring into the summer, we had kind of degraded into like a 6.4 or 6.6 based on blood work and numbers. So he suggested, "Why don't we start a couple rounds of chemotherapy and see how that works?"
Were you diagnosed with what stage? Or are you not into that?
I'm not into that.
Okay.
And the one of the neat things is because I don't physically have a tumor, they're very hesitant to actually put it at a stage.
Oh.
Because he says staging, mentally wise, is more adapted to someone that has a tumor that we can physically see and look at it and prove to someone this is what it is. When there's no tumor and it's just based on blood work numbers and such, it's not, I don't want to say it's a sliding scale, but it is very qualitative. But he says mentally for the patient, for him, he's found out that not staging it potentially has better mental repercussions.
I see.
Because, he doesn't want to say, "Well, it's a stage 2. When it might not be a stage 2, it might just be one blood draw a day, it shows up higher than another day."
Okay.
If that makes sense to you.
That makes sense.
So I was at about a 6.4. We went in for the first round of chemotherapy, and it has gone up through the last 2 rounds of chemotherapy that I've had. So it has not had very much success. It's kind of staved it off enough for me to lead a little different of a life the last year, but it definitely hasn't reduced the numbers like we would have hoped.
So what is their thought right now?
Their thought right now is that I have a pretty persistent little bunch of cancer cells in me that aren't reacting to very much chemotherapy. And we're kind of getting, you know, we're in the middle of a round now, so it's kind of getting to the point of we are having to move on to Plan B and Plan C because Plan A isn't working as well as we would have hoped. I opted last October, very oddly, in most medical circles, to abandon all treatment or anything to run the Iditarod, to train and to run the Iditarod dog sled race. So when I finished my last chemotherapy treatment last October, I kind of told them before I left that I will be back in April of next year. And, yeah, I'll see you then. And not to really bother me with too much, because I don't really care what they had to say. And I know there's a lot of people that are going to call me irresponsible for doing that sort of thing.
Well, but it's also your health.
Yeah.
You know? And no matter what somebody else says as far as like, oh, that's irresponsible of you, it is, like you said, it is what it is. And the way you deal with it may not be what people agree with, but they can't tell you how to live your life.
Exactly. And one of the big things that I have stressed to people is in that time frame between October and April was the mandatory time off between treatments. So it wasn't like I could have just continued with treatment. I did have to have mandatory time off to kind of let everything rejuvenate in the body and such. So it wasn't just me quitting in the middle. I did complete my round, and then we kind of discussed it, and we talked back and forth, and his theory, and along with kind of all my doctors, was it is progressive enough, and it looks like it's going to be a bad enough case in me that, you know, possibly postponing everything 2 or 3 years down the road to do something like run the Iditarod might not be feasible. So if I'm healthy enough and mentally, you know, stick-to-it enough to stick the plan of just continuing on and kind of ignoring it, this was probably the optimal winter to give it a go. And we did. Moved up to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in the middle of October and then lived there and then trained a 22-dog team to run the Alaskan Iditarod over the winter.
And how many miles is that?
About 1,049 is that race. But the dog team, we probably put anywhere between 4,200 and 4,500 miles on the team between October and when we got back home at the end of March.
Wow.
So, yeah, little different of a way to do things. I'm definitely not one to steer clear of a challenge.
So how was your health at that time? Was it all? Did you feel weak at all? Or
up in the first two rounds of chemotherapy that I had, other than the current one, I had very minimal side effects. I would come home and I wouldn't say chuckle, but I would I would definitely comment to people, I don't know what everyone's making such a fuss about.
What did they give you?
That's a very good question that I don't know the answer to.
Oh, okay.
I don't ask very many questions of my doctors. My theory is they want to see me alive as much as I want to see me alive, and they're not going to steer me in the wrong direction. And I'm not a doctor, and I didn't go to medical school, so they could definitely tell me the name of a medicine, and I definitely wouldn't care because I don't look things up on the Internet, and I don't do any of my own research, because I'm not a research doctor. I cut lawns in the summer, and I run a dog team in the winter. Cancer treatment is not my specialty in life. It's someone else's. And I don't have enough room in my little brain to bog myself down with ancillary knowledge of what they're giving me.
I see. You're anti of what I would recommend to people, but like I said, it is your life. I do recommend people if they want the knowledge that they should look it up. But however, if you don't want the knowledge, then that's fine as well.
It has worked out very well for me. My doctor says that I'm a unique individual to work with.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some very nice and very rewarding benefits to being a laid-back patient. My chemo treatments, I don't have appointments. Being somewhere at any given day, on any given time, is something that I'm just philosophically opposed to. I can't wrap my head around someone telling me to be somewhere as a free-thinking human. So I don't have an appointment. I have a day.
Oh.
It's my responsibility to show up to that office on that day. If I don't show up, that's my own fault. But they learned pretty quick that pigeonholing me into being somewhere at 9 o'clock in the morning is not good for anybody. So I don't know what I'm on. I don't know, and I don't really care. He looks, the oncologist and the team of individuals dealing with me look at the numbers when they have to, and they tell me, why don't you go get blood work or go get another MRI or go get another CAT scan, and I do. And I am definitely apprised of the results of all the tests when I run into them. But if I have an MRI on a Tuesday and they say, we'll have results in a couple of days, I am not one to call them Thursday night and say, hey, what were the results? If I see him next week, I see him and he'll tell me. If I don't, I don't. I'm definitely not going to lose sleep over it. In my mind, with the autoimmune disorder, the ulcerative colitis, stress of any sort can trigger a flare of my immune system.
Right. Well, that makes sense.
So if I've just trained myself up to this point of not caring what they say or when they say it, and I don't have to think about it, I don't get stressed when I take an MRI and they say it's going to take 2 days to get results. Some people are going to sweat bullets for 2 days that something's gone horribly wrong. I'm going to assume that it's not gone horribly wrong. And if it has gone horribly wrong, there's really nothing I can do about it anyways.
Right.
I'm still walking around with a different set of cancer cells bebopping around in me. It's up to them to either try to stave this off, stop it, or in due time prepare me that, hey, this is going to go bad. It's going to go south quick. You know, I run into a lot of cancer patients at the doctor a lot, and one of the things that I find difficult to deal with them is the boo-hoo attitude.
Oh,
of,
yes.
Oh, my God, I have cancer, and this is now going to bring life to a screeching halt. I don't want to say that I've gotten in heated arguments with other patients, but I am
a
little bit
segregated.
I have a
feeling that you have.
I am in a little bit of a segregated unit in my little doctor's office.
Yes.
I think a lot of the people are sick of them, of the nurses and everything, saying, oh, well, you know, Pat over here ran the Iditarod this year, and that's 1,100 miles across Alaska in the middle of winter, in the middle of nowhere. I think some of those people are kind of sick of it, that they say, oh, I might not be able to go shopping because I don't feel good. And then the nurse says, hey, Pat, how many lawns did you cut today? Oh, I don't know, like 25.
Well, yeah. I mean, every cancer is different, but I agree with you on the positive mental attitude thing. I've been in group therapies where people were like, oh, what was me and my husband and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, yes, we all have those days, you know what I say, but I've said that before, but the majority of your days, this is your life. I mean, if you want to live it as woe is me, then that's really no way to live.
Sure. And I don't say, hey, woe is me is a bad way to live. If that's the way that you want to consciously live life, that's great. Just don't do it around me.
Well, I'm all for a positive mental attitude, that's for sure. And you and I would probably be segregated as well. I actually, I was in a group and the moderator stepped away and this woman looked at me and she goes, oh, are you a cancer victim? And I was like, I am not a victim. I am a survivor. And I almost, like, literally lunged at her and, like, ripped her head off. Because I don't like the word victim.
I don't. Very rarely does it even come up that I have cancer. It came up quite a bit this year in the Iditarod because it's a neat story for them to go through. Just publicity-wise, obviously, I am a pseudo-professional athlete. And we
right.
do get a fair amount of media attention in the winter because of what we do and where we're at and such. But a couple of the directors of the Iditarod didn't even know it until, you know, 2 days before the race, they're scheduling the media events, and, you know, Chicago sends their crew up there to deal with this, and they're like, what, you? I'm like, yeah. He's like, really? You? You don't look sick. And that's one of those things that just drives me insane. It's like, you don't look sick. You have all your hair. I'm like, I know.
Right.
It's pretty neat that I have all my hair still. I'm always kind of amazed that people sound so disappointed. Like, you look great. Like, the Yeah, I do. I'm sorry that I'm not, you know, I don't look worse for you.
I know.
You're making a better picture.
I know how to make better PR. Can you look a little sallow for me, Pat? So
right.
I can...
A little gaunt.
Yeah. Yeah, I've gotten that a lot, too, and I hear that a lot from other cancer patients, other cancer survivors. When people are surprised how good they look, it's like, well, once again, I believe it's your positive mental attitude.
And one of the things that kind of bothers me about that is I look good. Like, one of the things they say that I hear a lot is, look good for having cancer. Really? So I don't look good normally?
Right, exactly.
I don't look stunningly handsome if I didn't have cancer, or... Boy, you look really good for a guy that's going to die.
Well, if somebody ever says that, you should say, well, we're all going to die.
Well, I've kind of gotten to the point now that when people say that, I will actually ask them, like, am I casket good? I mean, because people say, boy, they look good. And my response to the funeral is, they're dead. I mean, how good can they look? They're dead. So,
right.
My wife is always a little concerned when I'm out in public alone, because I don't have much of a social filter.
You? What?
I'll say, I do a lot of school presentations on the Iditarod, and she is a reading intervention specialist, and she's always horrified when I go to school, because I don't interact with sixth graders very well, because I'm used to dealing with 140 dogs. So the stopgap that most people would say is, hey, you know, you're talking to a bunch of sixth graders. To me, it's, I'm being paid here to be here for an hour to talk about the Iditarod. If you don't like me, then just don't pay me to come back next year, because
right.
I'm not going to volunteer to come back. So, yeah, it's a little more unique of a life that we lead than most patients.
So how many miles did you do for the Iditarod?
We got about a quarter of the way through the race before... In a section called the Dalzell Gorge, which is just a glaciated, hilly area, my dogs went around, I don't remember the whole incident, but we probably went down a hill and around a turn a little too quickly, and I hit my head on a tree and had to be airlifted out back to Anchorage to spend a few days in Anchorage to make sure that I hadn't knocked the last couple of two Super Bowls around and the hamster was able to get back in the wheel up there. But, yeah, so we trained for an entire season, for essentially two seasons of long-distance racing to only make it a quarter of a way through a 1,000-mile race.
Oh. So are you planning on doing the Iditarod again?
We're hoping to. Funding is always an issue with this. You have to, you know, when you have to house at least 22 dogs for a year, it gets expensive. I do have a job that I'm lucky enough that I can definitely take the time off and head back up to Alaska and try it again next year. If the funding is there, the plan definitely is to go back.
How do you get the funding?
Oh, through corporate sponsorships and speaking presentations and family sponsorships of a particular dog on the team. So we spend a lot of our time having our dogs autograph pictures to people and taking hoof prints and sending them neat little candid pictures of our leaders and our other dogs laying around in the sun waiting for it to snow.
That's cute.
Which is about as far away from Chicago as it can be today. It's a little warm.
So you're in Chicago right now?
I am. I'm in Chicago. We're in week three of the next round of treatment here, so I'm Chicago attached for at least the next 5 to 6 weeks, we think.
Excellent. So when do you head out to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan for
Most
training?
Most likely beginning to middle of October. It's just cool enough then that we can start putting the dogs in harness again and get them moving on four-wheelers and trying to move back and forth where it's safe enough for them to run, you know, any distance of a mile or so. Between now and then, we will kind of be out on the road between treatments and such for speaking engagements. We do a lot of motivational speaking engagements to corporations and team building and things.
Excellent.
One of the big things that we kind of harp on is out of the 17 individuals that are on my team, only one of them speaks English.
Oh.
And everybody else speaks a different language than I do, and they all speak dog. So I need to convey my wants and desires and demands to a team of 16 dogs who all have probably a different goal and a different mindset. So that kind of plays into my entire way that I think about a lot of things is is if I can get 16 dogs to, if I can communicate to 16 dogs and have them do what I want them to do, I can probably just tell my brain that, that this is what we're going to do. I don't have to convince my brain to do anything. I just got to tell it. So,
well, it's hard.
Pretty well like that.
It's hard to get 16 people to do what you want to do, let alone dogs.
Yeah,
dogs will probably be a lot easier.
Yeah, it's, there's a lot of days where I think I'd much rather be around 16 dogs than two other people.
Oh yes, I hear you on that one. So if people want to donate or get a hold of you for motivational speaking, where can they get a hold of you?
We have a website that has kind of a neat. It's about as user-friendly as it can be, and it has a journal of what it's like not only to train while you're kind of undergoing treatments, but then what it's like to go undergo treatments for a unique outlook. And it's www.pdmoon.com. Pretty easy.
Oh, excellent. Yep. And that'll give you all the information you want to get you in for speaking engagements or donations. Or
it has pictures of the dogs. It has dogs that can be... The program is called the Pooch Pal Program, where you get to adopt the dog, and you get emails, weekly emails from the dog, and pictures and such. And yep, all that's on the website. It's pretty easy. It's run by me, so it's not very technologically advanced. It's pretty simple, but it's fairly entertaining because I have a kind of a stream of conscious way of typing, and I don't really go back and reread it because
I have a feeling it's pretty fun.
Yeah, something like that. for about the last 3 or 4 years, I've had a sliding scale of how things go, and right now adequate is the new good for me.
Oh, okay.
So everything's just adequate.
Oh.
So, my wife and my mom, if it's adequate, they smile, because that's pretty good.
Well, we're going to have to bump that up for you. People listen to the podcast. They're going to have to check out your website and adopt a dog and help you out so we can have you back on again after you finish the Iditarod.
That'd be great. Or we can talk to you from one of the checkpoints next year, maybe.
Oh, that'd be
talk
sweet.
To you from Shack Tulik, Alaska, McGrath, and Roan, Population Zero.
Population Zero, why do they even have a sign?
They have a checkpoint because we have to track us throughout the race just to make sure we're safe. And it's just an interior village that's no longer a village that hits the trail perfectly. So, yeah, it's pretty neat to kind of just to look into what the Iditarod is all about. It's very interesting just to see that although dog sledding is not a huge thing in the lower 48, it is definitely still a way of life in Alaska.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for joining me, Pat. I'm going to wrap up like I usually do. You can always find me on Facebook because I'm a Facebook junkie. Mel Majoros, you can become a fan of the show or like it, as they call now on Facebook, The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com. Check out my blog, thecancerwarrior.blogspot.com. And you know what? Life looks pretty good from where I'm sitting. Sending you good vibes. It's The Cancer Warrior on EmpowerRadio.com.